We're really happy to have Professor Gabrielle Crooks-Wisner from Boston College Political Science Department. She'll be speaking on citizen claim making in rural India. Before we move too far, I'd ask you to turn off the ringers on your cell phone so that we're not interrupted with the speaker's exception. If you have a child in daycare, you can leave your phone on. The rest of you should turn it off. Professor Crooks-Wisner's research focuses on issues of political participation, local governance, and social welfare in developing countries, with an emphasis on South Asian and Indian politics. Her current book manuscript, Claiming the State, Citizens' Mobility and Demand for Public Services in Rural India, asks whether and how marginalized citizens of the world's largest democracy may make claims on the state for essential public services. Her PhD is from MIT in International Development, and her BA was from Swarthmore. So it's a pleasure to have you here today. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. Should we switch to...
I'm going
to
switch.
Yeah. I want to sit so I can actually see everybody, but also see my slides. So. Great. Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here, in particular for two reasons. First, because I'm relatively new to the BC community. This is my first year here, so it's really exciting to come and meet all of you and hear more about the work and conversations going on at the center. In addition to that, the work that I'm going to present is part of a book manuscript that I'm struggling with right now. So the feedback and the comments that you give me will be really essential in that process. This really, really is a work in progress. So with that spirit in mind, I'm really looking forward to your comments. Is this what I'm going to
do?
Yeah,
you can just use the right. Yeah.
Okay. So what I would like to do today is share some of the findings, some of the data and the findings from some field work that I completed relatively recently in rural India. And the central question, kind of the essence of the project, was this question of how do ordinary citizens, and in particular poor citizens, actually see and encounter the state in their day-to-day lives? There's this big thing called the state. What does this actually feel like? What are the encounters and the experiences that ordinary citizens have on a quotidian level, on a day-to-day basis, with this big amorphous entity, this thing that we call the state? And I look at that through the particular lens of public service delivery, asking both whether but also how citizens make claims on the state for the delivery of essential services, so things like drinking water, paved roads, schools, healthcare, and the like. And I start with this basic premise that what we call public services are rarely purely public. And I don't necessarily mean this in the sort of classic economic sense of a public good, but what I actually mean is that the kinds of things that sitting in this room we sort of assume will be delivered and be equally available and accessible to all. So we here at Boston College, we turn on the tap and water will flow, or we send our kids to school and we assume that the teacher will actually show up in the classroom and will do an adequate job of teaching, or when the roads have potholes, we assume, well, actually in Boston maybe we don't, but we would hope that the roads will be repaired and paved. These are the kinds of things that we think of collective public services, that we have an assumption that the state, be that the local state or the federal government, will provide. In many contexts, and many contexts in the developing world, and India, where I focus, is no exception, we need to relax the assumption that these are, in fact, public goods. And rather, we need to think about these services, in fact, as the subjects of political contestation. They're delivered in a highly discretionary manner, allocated along all sorts of different lines, be they ethnic or religious or class-based lines. And so these really are goods and services that we need to think about in terms of resources that are scarce and resources that are contested. And so it's with this in mind that I argue that looking at things that might sound rather mundane, like drinking water and paved roads and access to basic healthcare, really provide us with this really critical lens into issues of political participation and political representation that move us beyond the voting booth, beyond the realm of electoral politics, into this question of what it is that really happens on a day-to-day basis when citizens engage with and make demands on the state. Now, I pursue this in the particular context of... I pursue this in the particular context of the state of Rajasthan in India, which is located in northwestern India, I'll talk a little bit more about Rajasthan in a couple of minutes, but I completed over 18 months of field work in Rajasthan, a combination of both qualitative and quantitative work. On the quantitative end of things, I worked with a survey team, as an example of my survey team out in the field here, interviewing over 2,000 households about their access to a wide range of public goods and services and about the different strategies that they employ when trying to seek those services from the state. And then I also, in tandem with that and in a kind of iterative fashion, carried out over 400 interviews with residents of these villages, ordinary residents as well as local village leaders, as well as state officials and NGO staff and a whole range of other people. And it's on the basis of that I'm presenting some core findings. Usually when I do a talk like this, I would focus more on the quantitative end of things, on the survey data, but I'm actually going to do something a little different today and try and focus a little bit more on the qualitative findings of my work. And if there's interest and time at the end, I can go into some of the survey findings, but I'll focus more on the qualitative end of things today. And start out a little bit saying, well, why India? India is, as everyone in this room will know, the world's largest democracy. And this makes it a really interesting context for studying questions of political participation, not least because India is, in procedural terms, a resounding success in democratic terms. Over 60 years of fair and free elections with a slight hiccup in the 1970s with the emergency, but with the exception of that hiccup, free, stable elections over the last 60 years. India is also notable because it's one of the few countries in the world where the poor and the lower castes, in fact, participate in very high numbers, which is not what we see in a lot of other countries where there is an elite economic bias towards participation among the wealthy. And that is not true in India, so that makes it a particularly interesting case to study participation. But at the same time, there's a widely lamented and widely documented yawning gap between the process of democracy, what we can think about in procedural democracy, and the substantive outcomes of that democratic process and the extent to which citizens, and in particular poor citizens, are truly represented and the gains and the benefits, material otherwise, that they actually gain from their participation in democracy in India. And so this begs the question, how does India's democracy fare beyond the electoral arena, beyond the voting booth? And what is it that ordinary citizens actually do on a day-to-day basis when they're trying to access essential resources from the state? So that's sort of where the motivating question comes from. Am I not? Okay. Rajasthan, which you see located up here on the map, it's in northwest India. It's a fairly deserty place. It abuts Pakistan and also Delhi on the other side. So it's a big state. It's home to 68 million people, right? So larger than a lot of countries. So people always say, oh, you just work in one state. And I say, well, yeah, it's one state, but there are 19 different languages and dialects. There are over 400 different castes and tribes, and there are 68 million people. So this is a one-state study, but it's an enormously large and diverse place. It's a particularly interesting place because before independence, it was a series of princely states. So we can think about these in terms of being independent feudal holdings that were then, after independence, brought together into the state of Rajasthan and became part of the Indian Union. That said, there are these roots, what one would call princely or feudal roots, that are still very prevalent and very felt. And so people always talk about this as being kind of a, to use a non-politically correct term that would be a common parlance in India, they would call this a backward state, referring to levels of poverty, also the fact that it's rather remote, primarily rural, and also that it has this strong political legacy stemming from its princely and its feudal past. And so it's not a state where one would inherently expect to see very high levels of citizen mobilization and citizens articulating claims vis-a-vis the state. And so we can think of it almost as a least likely scenario, a least likely case. And that made it an interesting place to study it. It's also an interesting place because it's a place that, although it's a rather poor state, in fact, in recent years, in the last 10, 20 years, has seen a proliferation of public services. So it's not a failed state. The state actually is very present and does actually deliver a lot in terms of goods and services, but they're delivered in a highly uneven fashion. And so again, it begs this question about how different citizens navigate their local environment to attempt to access and garner some of these state resources. So what I'd like to do is start out illustrating part of the puzzle by focusing on two quotes drawn from two villages in the course of my field work. And the thing to notice here is that I'm interviewing groups of people in these two villages that are located about 5 kilometers apart. So they're located in the same state, in the same administrative block, in the same district, just kilometers apart. I'm speaking primarily to a group of men in both situations. There are some women on the sideline in one of the photos, but the people speaking here are men. They come from the same tribal community. They come from the Bhil tribe, which is a traditionally disadvantaged group in this part of India. They're also both laborers on government work sites, so they earn about $2 a day or less working on these government work sites. And so in terms of their caste and tribe, their gender, their occupation, and even their physical location, they're very, very similar people living in very similar places. And as you can see from these quotes, they actually express their expectations of and their relationship to the government in very, very different terms. So holding constant a lot of structural things about their lives in terms of caste and tribe and gender and occupation and income, they still express very different sets of expectations about what the state can and should deliver. So on the one hand, we have a group of people telling me, we know about Sarkari government schemes. We know our rights. We demand them. When the water is not flowing, it's the responsibility of the Sarkar. They bring the water from God knows where, but they bring the water. In this other instance, someone says, Sarkar, government? Where is it here? We have no services, no water. No one comes to us. We're excluded. What can we do? God willing, we survive. Right? So this is kind of, I think, a striking illustration of these really different perceptions of what the state can and should do. Now, the core question here is what accounts for such different relationships between citizens and the state, in particular when we hold constant so many structural things about the conditions of their lives. I'm not only interested just in whether citizens make claims on the state, but how they do it. And so here, in fact, I've drawn three quotes from the same village. So we're, in fact, holding everything about the village environment constant. So in the same village, you have individuals expressing, again, very different sets of strategies about how they would go forward in trying to claim services from the state. In the first instance, we have someone telling us that there's a lack of water in their neighborhood. The village council, the local elected council, doesn't hear them. At election time, the fat men show up, they make lots of promises, and then they forget us. The only way that we'll get water is to dig our own well. In the second instance, someone says, oh, there are all these schemes, there are all these services, electricity, education, welfare programs, but who's going to listen, who's going to hear the common man? We've gone so many times, they don't hear us, but finally we approach Mr. G, who's a caste leader in that community, so we approach this important, connected person. He's aware, he's Jagruk, he's aware. He knows how to get things done, so when the right people speak, then they listen. And the third instance is actually a young man aged 18 who was telling me a story about how he organized a local protest to protest teacher absenteeism in his school. And he says, when the teacher did not come, we organized ourselves. We went out to the main road, we blocked it with stones, and they had to pay attention. Even the district collector, who was a high official, came. The teacher was embarrassed and the issue was improved. So when the work is not done, go straight to the top. So again, we're holding constant the village. This is the same village, and we see people articulating very different approaches, both in terms of their expectations of what the state will deliver, but also in terms of how they organize themselves. In one instance, we see someone's basically given up hope of service delivery. In another instance, we see someone going through a mediator looking for a broker who can provide that linkage. And in the third instance, we see direct action. We see citizens actually mobilizing themselves. So this leads to a number of puzzles and questions that really are at the heart of my research agenda. The first is about participation. Who speaks up? Who actually raises their voice? Why is it that people living in the same places under the same structural conditions, some people participate in this way and some people don't? The second question is about representation, about the actual channels and strategies that are pursued. Why is it sometimes direct and sometimes mediated? And the third broader question that kind of cuts across all of this is about citizen-state relations. How do citizens actually navigate the state on a day-to-day basis? So what I'll do quickly, will you help me to manage time?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. What I'll do very quickly is show you just a snapshot of some of my survey data, just to give you a sense of what it is that people actually do. And I'll then present you with a streamlined version of my theory that I think helps to account for some of the variation that we see. And I'll illustrate that again with some qualitative examples. If there's time and interest, I can go into some of the quantitative work, but I'll probably table that and see if people want to ask about it later. So I hope everybody can see this, but what we're looking at here is just a very basic chart, just descriptive statistics from my survey data that talks about, first, the incidence of claim making. That is, the rate at which people report having personally contacted an official or gone through a broker or mediator to contact an official in order to make a claim, in order to make a demand for some kind of public good or service. Now, we can disaggregate which kinds of goods and services, and in other work I do that, but this is just the basic broad picture here. And the first really striking thing here is that most people do. Most people do make claims on the state. In fact, over 3/4 of the sample report engaging in this kind of claim-making activity. And this is really striking because the Indian state is often portrayed as this kind of distant, remote entity that's beyond the reach of the common citizen. When I first showed up for my field work in Rajasthan, I went to interview the head of a local NGO who said, "Oh, you're asking the wrong question. It's not why and how do citizens make claims. It's why don't they? Because no one does." And so in her view, the local population was really characterized by a lack of claim making. And what I found is the exact opposite. People really do make a lot of claims. The second thing, though, is that they do so in very diverse ways. They do so through a range of direct channels. The Gram Panchayat is a local village council, so through these local elected representatives, through political parties, through contact with appointed bureaucrats. And then they also turn to a wide range of mediators, from neighborhood associations and village associations to caste associations to non-governmental organizations and to social movements, or to a kind of amorphous category of people that we just call fixers. They're kind of the muckety-mucks, the ones who kind of get stuff done and go in between. So really diverse strategies. Lots and lots of claim-making, but really diverse strategies. Now, the third striking thing is that a lot of the variation that we see can't be explained by some of the usual suspects. So just to explain this really quickly, we see here just some simple histograms. Here, what you're looking at, and I'll walk through it because it's a little bit small for everybody to be able to see, but we're looking at quintiles of land ownership as a basic rough proxy for level of income or wealth. And what we see, in fact, is if our expectation would be that poorer people make fewer claims, or perhaps poorer people make more claims. In fact, there's no statistical difference between the richest and the poorest in terms of the incidence of claim making, right? So kind of basic economic status as an explanatory factor, I'm not saying that it doesn't matter, but it's an inadequate explanation. It doesn't tell us enough. Likewise, caste categories. So we're looking here at the scheduled castes and tribes, who are generally the lower castes. The other backward classes, which is kind of a middle grouping of castes, these are government categories, and the general castes, who are kind of the upper castes. And again, we see very little variation across caste groups. So class doesn't explain everything, caste doesn't explain everything. Gender, however, explains a lot. We see this real gap between the incidence of claim making among women and the incidence of claim making among men. However, if we look at caste and gender together, we see a much more uneven picture. So in fact, we see that it's the higher caste women, the OBC and general caste women, who are making fewer claims than the scheduled caste and scheduled tribe women. So this is counterintuitive when we think about kind of democratic theories that predict that it's in fact the local elite in terms of both economic and social standing who will participate more. This is not the picture that we see, and so it raises a puzzle about what other kinds of things we might need to look for to explain this. One of those factors, I suggest, is in fact what I call socio-spatial exposure. And what I mean by this is holding constant all these other features, caste, class, gender, land ownership, level of education, and so on, one of the key factors that seems to really make a difference is the degree to which a person moves about and is exposed to other people and places beyond his or her immediate community and locality. So what this actually means is that by moving around, for example, right outside of one's own neighborhood, or to another village for a source of employment, or through going on a bus to a local market, one is exposed to a set of resources. And those resources help to expand both the likelihood that a person makes claims on the state, but also the breadth of the strategies that a person employs in making those claims. So we see a greater likelihood of making claims on the state and a greater diversity of claim-making practices the more that a person moves about and is exposed in these socio-spatial terms. And this theory was developed over time, as I heard over and over in villages, people telling me stories about how they learned through observation about services that were available in some place. There's a working hand pump for water in that neighborhood, but it's not working in my neighborhood. Why is that? Or people recounted storytelling and gossip and kind of narratives that flew about service provision, and that people were learning from these stories and from these narratives. But the more limited one's locality, the more isolated and the less mobile one is, the more limited the sources of information and the ideas, and the more limited one's expectations about whether the state should in fact provide these services. And so the idea is that with basic exposure to difference, by which I mean different people and different places, one gains both access, that is, linkages to the state, but also information, ideas, know-how, that enable a person to make claims on the state. And so the key takeaway here is that this exposure to difference, to diversity, is in fact a resource for participation. And I don't want to take too much time, so I'll illustrate this really briefly with just a few qualitative examples. What we see here are instances of individuals who are talking about their expectations of service delivery and how those expectations are informed by what they see happening in other places. So in the first instance, we have a man who's a traveling cook. So he leaves his village regularly, and he travels throughout the state and even beyond the state. And he says, I see the way the world works. I see the government delivering services in other places. And I come home to my village, and I say, why shouldn't the government provide all those things here? So that's an example of how this exposure beyond his locality has expanded his notion of what he is entitled to. A much more local example, here's a scheduled caste or a lower caste woman who's saying, she says, we see how in other villages people are getting things, poor people like us. And so she goes on to say, the next time one of these programs or schemes are available, I'm going to make sure my son goes and that he puts our name down on the list, because I've seen that other poor people, just like me, can benefit. And then this third instance, even right in the same village, you have a scheduled caste man saying, over there in the main village where the wealthier people live, they have paved roads. The panchayat, the village council, brought water connections to every house. So where is our water? Where are our roads? Right. So these are examples of people having an expanded notion of what the state can and should do as a result of this exposure. People also gain ideas about what they can do. So not just what the state should do, but what they, as citizens, can do. So the ways in which they might approach the state. So here we have a woman talking about how, because she works as an agricultural laborer, she leaves the village, she goes out to the fields, and she says, I talk to people on the way, and in the fields you come to learn about who is good and who will help you. Someone will say, oh, so-and-so, he's jagruk, he's aware, he's connected, he can get things done. And so when the water pump is broken, I know where to turn. Another example, and this is actually the same individual that I referenced earlier, the 18-year-old who had organized the protest to block the roads, and I said, well, how did you think about this? Why did you do this? And he explained where this idea came from, and he said, well, my cousin brother works in Ahmedabad, which is a major city, and in Mumbai, and he tells us how people there block up the traffic and raise their voices when there's an issue to resolve. So I thought, let's try this here. Right, so this is, again, an idea, an illustration of how exposure to ideas and practices outside of one's own locality and community can expand not only the idea of what government should do, but what citizens themselves can do to hold government to account. A very last example, the other thing that citizens learn through this exposure is it's not just about information and ideas, but it's about the actual access and the connections that people have to material resources in the state. So two examples here drawn from the same village. These are two women, both from the scheduled castes. And in the first instance, you have a woman saying how there's one local official. He's the sarpanch. He's the elected official who's supposed to do this work. Who else would we turn to? He's the only point of contact. We're not connected people. There's the sarpanch and only the sarpanch. So when he lies about eating fruits, then what are we supposed to do? Nothing. We sit here and we die, right? A very bleak, pessimistic outlook because she has this one connection, and if he doesn't get it done, no one else can get it done. Now here's another person who says that she diversifies. She diversifies her approach. And she says, we asked and we asked. We went every which way, telling people about our need. This is how work gets done, by raising the issue to anyone with an ear, both here in the village and outside. Tell it to any official, any babu, which kind of means like big man, even the NGO people, right? So here what you see is this person kind of diversifying her strategies. And so the basic takeaway here is that through this socio-spatial exposure, through these connections and this mobility that extends beyond one's own community and one's own locality, we see people gaining resources that facilitates knowledge about what the state can and should do, information and ideas about service delivery and about entitlement to services, as well as enabling and motivating claim making by expanding the connections that people have, the actual access to the state that people have, as well as the diversity of strategies and ideas that people draw upon when they choose to make claims on the state. And what we see statistically, and I can talk about that later, but what we see statistically in my survey work is, in fact, that those people who are who have greater sources of exposure beyond their community and locality are, in fact, statistically more likely to make claims on the state and also do so through a broader array, a broader repertoire of claim-making strategies. And so socio-spatial exposure, I argue, is, in fact, a resource for participation. This diversity, this exposure to sources of difference, is something that people leverage in order to expand their notions of what the state can and should do, and their notions of what they as citizens can do. Those with greater exposure are more likely to exercise political voice and do so in more diverse ways. So what I'd like to conclude with are a series of questions about the implications and interpretation of these findings. The first implication is for our theories of participation. So the first thing we've seen is that some of the usual suspects related to socioeconomic status, related to caste, even sometimes related to gender, cannot adequately explain the variation that we see. And in fact, as I said, this diversity, exposure to people across these structural cleavages, can in fact be a resource that is leveraged for participation. There are also, I suggest, theories, normative implications for theories of citizenship. So if we normatively think that it's a good thing to have an active and engaged citizenry, then perhaps we need to be thinking about the conditions that produce citizen activism and the conditions that produce this kind of socio-spatial exposure might be a fruitful avenue for research when thinking about how, in fact, to spur and galvanize more citizen mobilization. The third question that I'll leave you, though, is a question of interpretation. Going back to the original question about how does India's democracy fare outside of the electoral arena? What does India's democracy look like in substantive terms beyond the voting booth? And what we see is very high rates of political participation defined in terms of claim making in one of India's poorest states among some of its poorest citizens. And my question, and I'm still agnostic on this, is whether this is in fact a good thing. On the one hand, we could interpret this as a highly motivated and highly active citizenry and as indicative of a robust and vibrant local democracy. On the other hand, we could say this is perhaps indicative of a democratic deficit where the state is failing to deliver and people are motivated to make such high levels of claims on the state because the state is not regularly delivering the services that we here in the U.S. So often take for granted. And so it's sort of a question of an interpretation that I leave you with, and I myself am still a little bit agnostic on which way to interpret these results. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much. Thanks very much. So we've got about a half hour, 20 minutes or so for open questions, and they can be specific about what you've seen or broader as well. So the floor is yours. And please introduce yourself before you speak so that others know who you are. Peter.
Yes, hi, I'm Peter Scarry from the Political Science Department. And I'm sort of grabbing for the air and so insistent because I wanted to, Gabby, ask you to kind of clarify a couple of background things as well as your basic findings, which I get the pieces, I'm not sure it all comes together. It's not clear to me what the correlates are of your basic finding. Who turns out to be these individuals who engage in socio-spatial sort of maneuvering? That would be my first question. And then more of a background couple of questions. What is the religious makeup of this mm-hmm. state? I don't know India well enough to know if being up near Pakistan means it's more Muslim mm-hmm. or not. I would think so, but I don't know. And then mm-hmm. in the example you gave of the young guy who got the idea from his brother mm-hmm. who spends time in Mumbai, mm-hmm. That suggests to me that people are not connected in any way with the media mass media and or the mass media in India wouldn't broadcast news of demonstrations in Mumbai to this part of India? That kind of question.
Yeah, no, these are great questions. And the sort of the brevity of the talk means that I had to skip over some stuff, so hopefully we can fill in these gaps as we go. So the first question was about, so I've made a claim that people who have greater socio-spatial exposure are more likely to engage the state in this way. And you're asking, well, what makes them have greater socio-spatial exposure?
No, characterize those people. It's not clear to me how that breaks out. They tend to be, the chart you put up with went by real quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So is it scheduled caste women, contrary to expectations, or what? That's what I'm asking. Characterize the...
So what I'm actually saying is that there's actually very little that's systematic about who they are in terms of class, caste terms.
Yeah.
There is a big gender gap, right? So the people who are more likely to make these kinds of claims are more often men. But
right.
Among women, we actually see that there's a lot of variation by caste as well.
Okay,
so the basic takeaway here is that some of the basic structural things that would be usual suspects
don't tell us
class or caste, they tell us something,
yeah.
But they don't tell us enough, and they don't adequately explain the variation that we see.
Okay.
And I argue that that is because socio-spatial exposure itself is so variable and in a way idiosyncratic. So there'll be different forces that become a driver of exposure in different people's lives, and that helps in a way to explain why we don't see the kind of variation that would be predicted by some of these more classic socioeconomic variables. And so, for example, one of the ways that I actually measure this is to look, I have a bunch of indicators of exposure, including working in a mixed caste environment, right? So if one goes to work with people from one's own caste community, or if one goes to work surrounded by people from other caste communities, right? So I have kind of things that I measure in my survey data that help to capture the degree to which people are not exposed. Now, there are tricky questions about causality and endogeneity here, right? So is there something about the kinds of people who are more exposed that just inherently make them more likely to be these active claim makers? And so one of the things that I do is I try to look at a variable that's exogenous to this model. So I look, in fact, at the land-to-labor ratio in the village. Let me explain what I mean by that. It's how much farmland is available relative to the workforce in that particular village. And the idea here is that the less land you have per capita in the village, the less likely you are to earn your living farming land in your own village. By extension, the more likely you are to have to go outside the village or to seek employment in alternative sectors that are more likely to take you out of your particular locality, out of your particular caste community, perhaps put you on a bus and move you to a nearby town, or to have you engage in different kinds of markets and different kinds of sectors. And so that, in turn, is a structural driver of exposure, which helps to explain in part why we don't see systematic variation across some of these other kinds of indicators. So those are some of the kinds of things that I'm looking at the survey data. Your question about the media is a great question. It's something just sort of statistically I control, right? I can control for newspaper readership and for exposure to TV and radio news. That said, I think there is something about the social element here. This isn't just an information story, right? And I'm going back in a way to work by sociologist Mark Granovetter about the strength of weak ties. And Granovetter makes this point that people read stuff in the newspaper all the time, but they don't necessarily internalize and act upon that information and that knowledge. And it's when you know someone who's done something, or you have firsthand experience, or even secondhand experience that's been sort of recounted to you through social channels, that information actually comes to life and that people can act upon it. So I'm drawing on some of those literatures about what actually, because there's information everywhere, and there is media penetration, and people do read the newspaper, but what actually brings that information to life? And I'm arguing that it's the social connection.
About Muslims?
Religion. Rajasthan does have a sizable Muslim minority, in particular on the border region. My sample, which is in four different districts, is 98% Hindu. And so religion was not a major player, not a major cleavage. And the bigger cleavage is caste cleavages, so caste distinctions within the Hindu community.
Okay. So we had a question. Was it you wanted you two folks? No? Okay. So we'll flip around the room. Paul, and then yes, here, and we'll go from there. Yeah.
First, I'm glad I'm not the one that brought up the word endogeneity. I'm an economist in the room. I'm in the econ department. Paul Cicchello. A couple things. First, I wasn't clear on which areas, how many areas you were in, because is this an area where scheduled caste, scheduled tribe are kind of randomly part of the Grand Pachan or not? I mean, mm-hmm. that would be one thing I was wondering. The media is another, definitely, like, is that then a policy outlet? And you're saying maybe, maybe not, but I mean, we just had a speaker last time mm-hmm. talking about this teen mom too. I love this, you know, there's an effect of on teenage pregnancy, they're claiming in the U.S., because yeah. so many young mm-hmm. people are watching Teen Mom 2, they're realizing the way that it really is. It's actually changing the amount of pregnancies that are going on. Mm-hmm.
It's lowering them. Maybe.
Lowering them right. substantially. But I also wanted to just, there was a third thing that I'm just, mm-hmm. the reverse effect.
Mm-hmm.
So you're promoting this in one direction, that I talked to my brother and he was yeah. at the protest, but what if the protest was shut down and he went to jail? I mean, that. So are you picking it up in both directions, or are you only picking it up in terms of options that are available and therefore any bad option they weed out? Or why mm-hmm. should we think about this in both directions or mm-hmm. just in one direction?
Yeah, those are fantastic questions. Just sort of descriptively, I can tell you, you asked about kind of the distribution of castes. And I purposefully selected four districts that had very different caste compositions
mm-hmm.
so that I could sort of across my survey data control for some of these differences in distribution of castes by looking both within and then across those different districts and areas. One of the interesting things, though, is that scheduled castes, I mentioned they're listed in a schedule of the Indian Constitution as being as meriting affirmative action. And
yeah.
so seats in local government, including in the panchayat, the local village council, are in fact reserved for members of the scheduled caste. And so their distribution in local politics is actually constitutionally guaranteed and constitutionally mandated, right? So it means in fact that the scheduled castes are very embedded in local politics and in these local village councils. And that's consistent across all of the areas that I work in. This example about teen mom and whether, you know, media penetration, I mean, I push back on that. I think this is not an information story, or not solely an information story. I think that in part because there's a lot of literature that shows that simply telling people things, public information campaigns and PR campaigns, really don't have the effect that we sometimes expect them to have, right? So there's been work, for example, in Mexico on local service delivery and accountability where people have gone out and said, here's a report card of how your local officials are performing. And it has almost no effect. Or likewise in India, where people have gone out and said, here are some of your rights as workers on these government work sites. This is how much you should be being paid. And it has almost no effect. So information in and of itself is not enough. There has to be something that brings information to life. And that can be being mobilized by an NGO or a social movement, or it can be, in my story, the fact that you have exposure to people who are acting upon that information, and that in turn has an effect on you.
But
it's closely related. Go ahead.
You mentioned that people feel they know them. And I mm-hmm. think that's one of the things about the teen mom is you're actually watching, it's a reality. Like,
mm-hmm.
you get to know this person, and you see what's
mm-hmm.
happening in their life. So I think that's the distinction, is more of a, in the middle of a soap opera, if you're seeing the in our soap opera, they
mm-hmm.
did the service. Would that then be enough to be like this person who knows somebody like me?
I guess that's plausible. I mean, if reality TV is enough of a reality that people sort of, the quote that I had up on the slide about I see poor people like me
yeah.
benefiting. I mean, if one actually does identify enough with the, you know, with the characters. I mean, there's been actually a lot of attempt to use soap operas in Indian television as a kind of public media outreach and sort of PR platform. I don't know. I'm sure people have studied this, sort of how effective that is. I still maintain that when it comes to something sort of as daunting and intimidating as standing up in a public meeting and demanding a resource from an elected official, that's different than a sort of personal decision you would make in your own life about whether or not to have unprotected sex, right? So it's something about the sort of the risk that one is undertaking when you stand up in public and articulate a claim on government, which is, I think, a slightly different animal and perhaps why the social dimension to this matters so much. But I do, you had asked an excellent question about whether there's also a negative story here, right? So, and you're absolutely right. The arrow does work in both directions. So if one is exposed over and over again to negative stories of poor performance and repression. And I actually did interview a bunch of women who said, they were gossiping and telling stories about someone who'd gone to the office of a local bureaucrat to complain about sporadic electricity supply, and one of the bureaucrats had actually slapped one of the women. I don't know if the story was true, but it was a story that was being told. And it's a great illustration of your point, which is that the information and the stories and the narratives that flow can also be negative, and they can also have a chilling effect on one's participation. But that's where this issue of not just the quality, but also the quantity of information comes into play. So if one moves in very, very small circles, one will hear that story about the bureaucrat who slapped the woman over and over again. And that will be the only narrative and the only discourse that one hears. But as your social sphere expands and as one moves about and gains exposure to other sources of information, it's likely that you'll hear that story, and it's a negative story, which may have a chilling effect, but you're likely to hear other stories too. And the probability of hearing success stories, therefore, expands. So there's an element to this model which is, in fact, probabilistic.
Yes?
Hi, I'm Anjira, and I'm a senior here. I'm kind of curious about perhaps, like, at least the ages, because at least with the case of, like, the protesters, they happen to be younger, mm-hmm. and I'm curious, like, what role that played, as well as just, like, culturally, because I don't really know a lot about Rajasthan and, like, how maybe has this social, spatial theory, has it expanded because of, I guess, like, the advent of more people talking about globalization and interconnectedness? Like, has this always been something, or is it just, like, a new phenomenon?
Okay. On age, it's kind of a horseshoe-shaped relationship. So we do see, so I only interviewed people above the age of 18 and older. I only interviewed adults. So we do see more activity among younger people and older people. And not quite sure why that is. I think in particular among women, the older you are and the more status you have in your community, the easier it is to move about and the easier it is to speak up. So it is, in fact, often older women among women who are more active. That said, among men, it's often younger men. So that may sort of wash out in the data to produce this sort of horseshoe kind of shape. And in my broader statistical work, age is clearly also something that's sort of controlled for as well. So it matters, it plays a role, but when I talk about the effects of exposure, I'm controlling for age, right? The same way that I'm controlling for gender or controlling for caste. In terms of kind of socio-spatial exposure in the state of Rajasthan or India broadly, and kind of is it increasing or growing, or is it being driven by discourses about globalization and stuff, I actually see it as kind of a more kind of structural, economic, and institutional story. So I see that there are really big changes in the rural economy, and this has a lot to do with the distribution of land and the fact that land is becoming more and more scarce, partly due to land degradation, but partly due to the subdivision of land holdings among families. So plots of land are getting smaller and smaller. I talked about the land to labor ratio. And what this means is a real diversification of incomes in rural India. So whereas several generations ago, people primarily earned their living from farming and from agriculture, that's no longer true. And there's a real diversification of incomes. And that diversification in itself is something that's driving this exposure. So you're engaged in different microenterprises, you're engaged in different markets, you're moving around to be part of those different markets, you're engaged in different sectors, you're employed on government work sites. All of these are, in fact, drivers of mobility, because people are no longer just bound to particular plots of land. So there's a structural change in the rural economy that's driving some of this. There are also institutional changes. So the government of India has implemented these affirmative action policies that are institutionally creating opportunities for women and the lower castes to enter the public sphere and enter positions in their community that they previously did not have access to. So that's an institutional driver of this increased exposure, right? So I think there are a lot of different drivers. It's not necessarily a story of globalization, but it is a story of market forces and of structural economic change and also institutional change.
Yeah, Peter.
If nobody else, a couple of things. I'm wondering what I don't know about Indian politics that would explain how little parties are, according to your data, bureaucrats and parties were equally approached at mm-hmm. something like 20% or mm-hmm. less. It seemed
yeah.
kind of low. So a different way of asking a question, I mean, aren't there political entrepreneurs about
mm-hmm.
who might take advantage
of
this?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's a great question.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is kind of striking, right? The political parties are pretty low, and so are bureaucrats.
Yeah.
The panchayat, So panchayat officials are politicians. They are elected in elections. They are ostensibly nonpartisan. They're not allowed by law to run on party platforms, but informally they have very, very strong linkages to parties. So a lot of connections to parties actually work through the panchayat. So there is a strong party linkage, but it's mediated through the panchayat. Likewise, the bureaucrats are appointed by parties and then are transferred and moved around. So again, there's sort of a linkage to parties through bureaucrats. There's also this category that I call fixers.
Yeah.
And they are very often the people who have connections up here to parties, right? So they're individuals, they're again, ostensibly nonpartisan individuals, but they actually are extremely partisan and they have all these ties up here. So parties are playing a really big role, but they're not playing a big role as parties with a capital P. They're playing a big role as parties because they've penetrated all these other institutions. And so access to resources does come through the party, but it comes through the party mediated through these other actors and institutions.
Does that mean the parties don't get credit for it? Or?
No, they do, because people are sort of savvy and they know how resources flow. But what this does also underscore is sort of a key feature of Indian politics that scholars have focused on for a long time, which is that we talk so much about India as this patronage democracy and the role of partisanship in party politics, but in fact, parties in rural India are weakly institutionalized. They have very, very weak roots in rural areas, and that's because most party headquarters are urban, they're in towns and cities, most politicians themselves are urban. They don't actually have strong institutional roots in a rural area, and that's why this diversity of actors and institutions is in fact necessary and is being leveraged by parties the same way that citizens are also leveraging it.
I had a question about the... Did you ever...
No.
Oh, okay. That's a hair turn. Okay. You mentioned about the how people think of the state as one of your interests. And could you speak a bit about that in the Indian context and maybe compare it to the what you see in the American context of the vision of the state versus the government versus the society at different levels?
So I think one of the key features when I think, and again, I'm drawing on interviews with rural individuals and the villages that I visited in this corner of India, right? So it's, I'm hesitant to generalize too far, but one of the key features, this is also something that's sort of supported in the broader literature on cities and state relations in India, and in particular in rural India, is that the state matters, maybe much, much more than it does in our lives here in the United States. And what I mean by that is, without linkages to the state, you don't have linkages to a whole range of critical resources that, given the levels of poverty and given the levels of deprivation, are really, really essential. You depend on the state for jobs, you depend on the state for welfare, you depend on the state for roads, you depend on the state for drinking water. And although there is a vibrant private sector, and there are, for example, new and burgeoning private schools, primarily people still depend on the public sector and on public schools and on public drinking water and on public doctors. And so the public sector and the state is a really crucial and integral part of life in India, and in particular in rural India. And what this means is that the state matters. And so this question of accessing the state and making demands and claims on the state is a question of life or death. It's crucial. And for us, it's kind of, well, do I pay my taxes? Do I go to a town meeting? Do I go out to vote? I'll turn on the tap and the water will still run whether or not I do those things. If I really don't pay my taxes, I might go to jail, so maybe I'll do that. But, you know, there's a lot less at stake because we live in a more institutionalized, programmatic, and rule-bound society where things work the way we expect them to. And in India, we need to relax a lot of those assumptions. Not just India, but in a lot of places in the world. We need to relax a lot of those assumptions. And that means that fighting to access resources from the state really is about fighting to access the things that enable you to live a healthy and productive life, which is much more central and crucial than a lot of the decisions that we, sitting in this room, will make on a day-to-day basis.
Including plowing the streets and things like that that we take for granted.
Right.
Well, thank you very much. This has been really terrific to have
you
here.
Thank you for the comments.
Thank you all for being here.